Welcome to Sound Bites in Modern Art. This is Dr. Jean Ouellette. I'm an art historian and an art critic who specializes in modern and contemporary art and theory, and I am the author of these podcasts. One of the most important debates of modern art is that discussion around one question: what is the purpose of art? Although from the vantage point of 200 years later, the obvious answer was the position of Immanuel Kant, that art had no purpose other than its own purpose. The art for art's sake stance took 100 years to evolve and become accepted practice. While it is possible to see artists, especially the avant-garde, demanding more and more freedom in the 19th century, artistic freedom is not the same as art for art's sake. Perhaps this is why one of the first definitive clashes between the artist and public expectations of the role of the artist evolved into a larger argument over the definition of art itself at the end of the century. The clash was between two titans of art, the respected and established art critic and champion of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, John Ruskin, and the controversial and infamous artist, James Whistler, called Jimmy by his friends. In 1879, Jimmy was broke, in desperate need of funds. His single-minded devotion to perfection in art-making and his unyielding determination that his was the right vision had led him into a final break with his patron, Frederick Leyland, over the liberties the artist had taken with the interior design of the Peacock Room in Leyland's home. In addition, the artist butted heads with the City of London over the all-too-modern, all-too-plain, all-too-white house he and the architect E. W. Godwin designed. The White House, as the building was called, was on Tite Street in Chelsea. It was censured, and its clean, simple facade was condemned. Building an aesthetic home of a highly unique design was expensive, but totally in keeping with Whistler's aesthetic, a reductiveness long apparent in his paintings. It was the stripped-down, unornamented front of the house, pale brick which had been whitewashed, that clashed with the approved and ubiquitous Queen Anne houses of red brick architecture designed by architect Norman Shaw. 150 years later, we know that Whistler was right. The Peacock Room became a masterpiece because of his interference. The White House was a statement of modernist architecture almost 40 years before the Austrian architect Adolf Loos wrote Ornament and Crime in 1908. And Whistler would also prevail over John Ruskin, but the cost would be high for both men. By 1878, Whistler was in desperate need of money. He had plenty of fame. He and E.W. Godwin had displayed their joint work of art, the Butterfly Cabinet, in a room designed by the architect in Paris at the Exposition Universelle. This collaboration produced one of the most beautiful and celebrated works of furniture of the century, but Whistler was still broke. He took advantage of the new opportunity to show his nocturnes at the inaugural exhibition of the Grosvenor Gallery, owned by the art connoisseur Sir Coutts Lindsay, a veritable palace of art, as it was called, established expressly to sell contemporary art. The 1877 opening was a glittering affair, attended by Queen Victoria's son, Edward VII, Prince of Wales, and his wife, the Princess Alexandra. Whistler's nocturnes, first called Moonlights, had evolved out of his views of nighttime in London's Cramer Gardens. The term nocturne was suggested by Leyland, who admired Chopin. Inspired by Hiroshige and the current rage for Japanese-ma, Whistler worked in a series of paintings of the banks of the Thames and stripped the scenes of narrative in order to find the essence of the idea. The reductive and conceptual darkness of the views of what was a lively park by day meant that only the outlines of forms could be seen in the fog, and that the dark blue sky would be lit by bursts of fireworks, which would shoot into the sky, explode into a burst of gold, and in tiny bits of light drift towards the river. The approach of the artist away from the narrative and towards the concept, away from the moral and towards the idea, away from the details of nature to the essence of the experience of nature, would infuriate John Ruskin, who believed that art must be, for moral and ethical reasons, in the service of nature. Fidelity to nature was tantamount to obedience to God. A good artist observed and delineated nature's bounty in order to convey a message to the viewer. A true artist was a laborer laborer, a humble transcriber who took pride in craft, like a monk making a manuscript in a scriptorium of a monastery. At least that was what Ruskin had proposed for the past 40 years. Whistler's method of painting was an anathema. He lay his canvases on the floor, covered them with glazes and washes of thin paint. Once they had solidified enough to not drip, the artist would hang them out to dry, like laundry. The last steps were the additions of forms, simple shapes, as seen in Nocturne in Blue and Gold, Old Battersea Bridge, or touches of color in Nocturne in Blue and Gold, Falling Rocket. Predictably, Ruskin was outraged. Where was the labor? Where was the craft? Where was the art? Whistler, Ruskin asserted, was a coxcomb to ask for 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint in the public's face, end quote. Whistler, in turn, was equally outraged. He had a sense of self-determination and artistic entitlement not uncommon among the avant-garde, but suddenly the prospect for a highly public battleground presented itself. Previously, battles between the avant-garde and the establishment had been relatively confined to books, newspapers, to salons, to exhibition halls. But in London, where artists had many more venues and opportunities than in Paris, a fight between Whistler as the harbinger of all ideas modern and Ruskin, preserver of all values traditional. Well, this was a war the London public could understand. Home decorating magazines, newspaper articles, satirical magazines, plays, lectures, all helped to popularize the artistic issues of the day in London. A character called the Harmonist in a well-known play was obviously Whistler, who, due to his friendship with Oscar Wilde, the poet and playwright who coined the term house beautiful, was associated with British interior design. For the Victorians, the decorative movement, called the aesthetic movement, was a matter of international trade and market dominance, a serious business worthy of constant reporting. Whistler was a favorite subject. Whistler's nocturnes were extreme, even compared to the Parisian avant-garde. The painting style was raw, simple, covering washes, beyond an unfinished sketch. The titles were suggestive rather than informative. At least the Impressionist would give you the name of the site. And the end result of the nocturnes was an abstract idea. Ruskin attacked the May exhibition and the Grosvenor Gallery. Quote, "For Mr. Whistler's own sake, no less than for the protection of the purchaser, Sir Coutts Lindsay ought not to have admitted the works into the gallery in which the ill-educated conceit of the artist so nearly approached the aspect of willful imposture. I have seen and heard much of Cockney impudence before now, but never expected to hear a coxcomb ask 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint in the public's face," end quote. The English genre artist William Frith was not impressed. Testifying for Ruskin, the painter of Derby Day in 1850 explained Whistler as being a victim of his own famous self-indulgence and of his French education. Frith was not incorrect. Certainly, Whistler was an egomaniac, and he was definitely influenced by the concept of l'art pour l'art, put forward at mid-century by Parisian writer and critic Théophile Gautier and Charles Baudelaire, who created a theory of correspondences, synesthesia, among all the arts, including interior design. Baudelaire, in turn, had admired Whistler, whose later nocturnes mirrored the poet's equation of poetry, music, and night darkness. At the trial, Whistler tried to explain synesthesia, correspondences, or what he thought of as harmony. As Whistler explained while talking about the Battersea Bridge, quote, "I did not intend to paint a picture of the bridge, but only a painting of a moonlight scene. As to what the picture represents, that depends upon who looks at it," end quote. The artist, learning from the Pre-Raphaelites, designed his own frames to coordinate in design and color with the paintings they surrounded. Like the penciled butterfly signature on a tab on each of his prints, the frames were part of a total work of art. By controlling the frames, Whistler gained partial control of the environment or the surround for his art. As he explained about the Falling Rocket, quote, "It is an artistic arrangement. The black monogram on the frame was placed in its position with references to the proper decorative balance of the whole," end quote. The Impressionist also used customized frames of their own designs and colors, but although they knew Whistler quite well, they credited themselves with the concept of the art frame. To be fair, Whistler's frames were almost uniformly a more traditional greenish gold to harmonize with his frequent use of Prussian blue, called Hero-Ai, that's spelled H-E-R-O-A-I, in Japan, where Berliner indigo was often used in Yukio-E prints. The blues were Whistler's homage to the Japanese. The Impressionist, in contrast, painted their frames in colors to harmonize with the varied colors in their paintings, and they made sure the gallery walls were painted in dark jewel tones to offset the bright blue colors of the canvases. All ideas learned from Whistler, who is much better understood and appreciated in Paris than in London. But it was a London jury who agreed that Whistler had been libeled by Ruskin and awarded him one farthing. The verdict was at best patronizing. One farthing in 1878 was as little money then as it sounds today. Certainly not enough to help Whistler financially. He declared bankruptcy. The White House on Tite Street was put up for auction and purchased by Henry Quilter for less than Whistler had spent on it. Helpless, Whistler could only protest futilely when Quilter complied with the Metropolitan Board of Works and applied appropriate but disfiguring ornamentation. The White House survived the London Blitz, but was demolished in 1865. Well-versed in the virtues of self-promotion, Whistler published his own account of the trial, called the Ruskin Pamphlet. Whistler versus Ruskin, Art and Art Critics, came out in 1878, its cover bound in brown paper. Whistler was down, but not out. During the early 1880s, he had several comeback exhibitions, all carefully harmonized. The gallery became a total work of art, and he decided to separate himself from the arts and crafts movement and from the aesthetic movement. The former had become too popular, and the latter too decadent. Whistler had been made famous by his friend, the poet and playwright Oscar Wilde. On his House Beautiful lecture tour, Wilde described Whistler's dining room in the White House as an example of modern interior design. Whistler, however, was not amused. He felt Wilde was stealing and diminishing his serious ideas about art, and Whistler was correct. Wilde's interpretation led to misunderstandings of Whistler's intentions about the role of decoration. For the painter, it was the work of art that was paramount. Of such importance, each room had to have harmonizing surroundings, interior design, for the art object itself. Whistler, a veteran of the chaotic salon style of stacking paintings from floor to ceiling, considered the room or gallery to be entirely secondary to the art. Wilde seemed to suggest that the House Beautiful should come first and that the owner should be careful to select appropriate art to enhance the decor. Whistler struck back in his famous 10 o'clock lecture of 1885. The artist planned the occasion as carefully as he did his exhibitions, designing the invitations sent to 1,500 people, dressing with his usual dandy-esque panache, and arriving precisely at 10 p.m. at the Prince's Hall on February the 20th, 1885. 500 people came, filling every seat. Whistler mocked the aesthetic movement, which attempted to improve the morality of the benighted public through the tasteful application of art to all things, even useful things. The true artist, Whistler insisted, had a higher calling. Art was more elevated. The artist, quote, brings forth from the chaos of nature, glorious harmony, end quote. And Whistler continued, nature contains the elements of color and form of all pictures, as the keyboard contains notes of all music. But the artist is born to pick and choose and group with science these elements, that the result may be beautiful, as the musician gathers his notes and forms his chords until he brings forth from chaos glorious harmony. To say to the painter that nature is to be taken as she is to say to the player that he may sit at the piano, end quote. The 10 o'clock lecture became famous. Whistler presented it over and over until 1891, when he was living in Paris. In 1885, he printed the lecture privately in the now famous brown paper covers, and 3 years later, it was published publicly. That same year, Claude Monet introduced his friend Whistler to the French poet Stéphane Mallarmé, who immediately translated the 10 o'clock lecture into French in 1888. Whistler's assertion of art for art's sake, his decisive separation of art from purpose, caused a furore in Paris. but was influential among the French avant-garde and an unlikely inspiration for Art Nouveau. Despite the years of delivering the lecture, Whistler was increasingly unappreciated by the British, who did not comprehend his abstract theory of art. Given the old saying that a prophet is unrecognized in his own time, it would seem to follow that James Whistler would today be thought of as an avant-garde philosopher who fought for art's sake, but not so. In the endnotes to his 2004 book, Uneasy Pieces, David Park Curry stated that Whistler is still unappreciated today because he could not be classified as belonging to any one nation. But I have suggested that the neglect of this artist was also because he could not be fitted into any one movement. Even in his own lifetime, Whistler complained about being misclassified. Quote, "See, that's how they write the history of art," he said, when a critic lumped him in with the illustrator Walter Crane and the minor Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood painter Spencer Stanhope. Straddling categories, Whistler was an Andy Warhol long before a Warhol. As the Whistler scholar Sarah Burns pointed out, quote, "By so aggressively placing himself in the public eye, flinging himself, not his paint pot, in the public's taste, Whistler managed to hold together two realms of taste, the popular and the elite, that in the later 19th century were just beginning to show the strains of a widening fissure between them," end quote. In addition, Whistler stood up for the right of the artist to produce art on his or her own terms. During the Whistler versus Ruskin trial, the artist was questioned about his manner and method of painting. Quote, "The labor of 2 days, then, is that for which you ask 200 guineas?" End quote. Whistler replied, very famously, "No, I ask it for the knowledge of a lifetime," end quote. The famous nocturnes were conceptual, evocative abstractions of his responses to nature, but they were also studies in the possibility of paint or truth to materials, another idea that would take decades to be fully articulated. As Linda Nochlin pointed out in 1971, quote, "Truth to the nature of materials was achieved, at least theoretically, first in England in the realm of the decorative arts, where the role of subject matter and imitation of nature could be more easily played down than in the traditional representational high arts of painting and sculpture." Ironically, Whistler was so far ahead of his time that history has subsequently left him behind. And finally, there were the practical problems of bringing Whistler's paintings together for an exhibition. The Freer, the Fog, the Frick cannot lend key works. No catalogue raisonné of his oils was published until 1980. In the end, Whistler had burnt all of his bridges in England. In 1888, he married Beatrice, the widow of his great friend E.W. Godwin, who had died in 1886. The happy couple lived in Paris from 1890 to 1901, 2 years before he died. Writing a letter to Whistler in 1885, Oscar Wilde said it best, quote, "Be warned in time, James, and remain as I do, incomprehensible. To be great is to be misunderstood," end quote. Tune in, click on, download. Thank you very much.